a lot of people are familiar with art therapy, the concept of making art as a way of dealing with, you know, depression or grief or some other pain. You've got a different idea with this book, the idea that there can be a therapeutic value just in looking at art.
That's right. This is specifically about the spectator of art and what they can get out of it. And really, the starting point is so simple, and that is, what is the point of looking at art? And it's such a kind of naive question that sophisticated people like to think, well, obviously, you know, we always knew that a long time ago. But I just go back to the beginning, because I've often felt a bit puzzled in museums and in front of works of art, and just thought, how does this fit into my life? What am I allowed to do with this? Is there any sort of good or bad way of behaving in front of this work of art? And it's kind of my belief that at the end of the day, if art's got to, in some ways, do something for us, it's a tool. And the book is an attempt to say, okay, what sort of tool is it? And what can it do for us?
Well, so, for example, let's take a painting everyone knows, the Mona Lisa. What kind of therapeutic insights might the Mona Lisa inspire?
First of all, the Mona Lisa is such a difficult painting to have any kind of personal relationship with, for the simple reason that it's so famous.
It's also behind about three sheets of glass.
Right. So in other words, you're going to have a very unnatural relationship with it. So you have to quieten the noise that surrounds your interaction with the picture and just ask yourself a very simple question. What do I like about this painting? And let's imagine that, you know, one of the things that's quite nice about this painting is that the Mona Lisa looks quite nice. Now, this seems really odd and a really sort of stupid thing to say. But, you know, if you wanted a friend and you were sort of looking around, you might think, oh, actually, this woman's quite friendly. And why do you think she looks friendly? Well, there's something about her eyes and her mouth which seems tender, complicated, slightly humorous, but indulgent. She's the sort of person that you feel like you could tell something a little bit embarrassing to. And rather than her judging you or, you know, coming in with stinging criticism, she would say, okay, I understand. Maybe it wasn't a great thing to do, but life is complicated. She seems to be somebody who you can tell a complicated thing to. She's understood, you know, the wisdom of the years and the follies of mankind.
But that's lovely. Instead of looking at the Mona Lisa as a famous painting, you're just looking at her as a friend, an interesting person. And then she's perhaps helping you access emotions you might then examine in yourself.
That's right. And this is very much the approach of the book. At one point, we look at a mother and child, you know, beautiful classical Bellini mother and child. You know, there are thousands of them in museums around the world. And, you know, when you just step back and think, okay, what is going on here? Why is it nice to look at this? This is basically a work of art that is making the idea of hanging out with your mother when you're about, you know, 8 months and sitting on her lap, it's reminding you of a deep sort of primordial joy and sense of security, which, of course, as we grow up, we're not supposed to be mummies, boys and girls. We're supposed to be tough, grown-up creatures. But all of us long, particularly at moments of difficulty, at things were not going right, etc., we long to go back to that primitive, primal cuddle. And that's what one of these great icons of one of the world's great religions is all about. Mm. It's about the security of childhood.
So it's almost like getting a little hit of tenderness.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the word tenderness, because tenderness has got really low esteem. You know, if you say, I'm interested in, you know, guns, money, fame, power, people think, okay, great, that's, you know, great guy. If you say, well, look, I'm really interested in tenderness, that sounds so weird. That sounds so odd. But I'm really interested in tenderness. I think there isn't enough tenderness in the world, which is separate from mawkishness or sentimentality or soppiness or any of these derogatory terms. Tenderness is a due recognition of the vulnerability that is in each of us, of the childlike part that is in each of us. And, you know, the reason why the mother and child was such a popular kind of icon of Western art is that it taps into something psychological, you know, that came along way before religion did.
So I'm curious, what would you change about the experience of going to a museum? Because right now, let's say, you know, we go to a famous museum, we walk through the galleries, we stop in front of paintings, we read the little tag on the next to the painting, you know, it tells us the artist, the title, maybe when it was painted. Is there anything in that you would change?
Totally. I mean, look, I think that museums, have unbelievable prestige in our societies. You know, in every big city in the United States, when there's some surplus wealth, what do people use that surplus wealth for? They give it to the museum. In the same way that in the Middle Ages in Europe, people used to give money to the cathedral. It's like it's the place of the highest repository of values. But when you go into these places, they promise, I think, to do more than they actually do. And part of the reason is that they've been hijacked by an unfair academic agenda. So just think of the way that the rooms are laid out. They're laid out by things like, you know, the Renaissance, the 19th century, you know, Impressionism, Cubism, etc. These are the names of the rooms. Now, that's fine if you're an academic historian. You know, that's the way that these guys operate. But as an ordinary member of the public, I'm not interested in a room in Cubism just like this. I carry the sort of things that we all care about, interest in work, mortality, friends, family, the country I live in and its challenges it's facing, etc. These things come before any interest in, you know, the 19th century. And if I was in charge of organizing museums, which I can tell you a little bit more about it because I have been put in charge of a few museums, but if I was really in charge of museums, what I would do is I would give over sections and rooms to particular themes in our life. So, for example, there would be a room on love, and the room on love would put before your eyes a number of works of art that aim to stimulate, provoke, re-enchant, and nourish you in the areas of relationships. You know, I put one of the works that I'm very keen on is there's a wonderful, in the National Gallery in London, there's a picture by Pisano called Daphnis and Chloe, which shows a loving couple on the very first night that they've been together. It's incredibly tender and incredibly full of appreciation. And, you know, I would show any married couple with a couple of kids and a busy work life, I would take them back to that Pisano and I'd say, that's how you guys used to be. Just remember how it used to be and remember where you, and look at where you are now. And, you know, think about that. Think about that level of appreciation. I would use that picture as a way of provoking those thoughts.
You know, people's taste in art is so extremely personal. I mean, the painting I love might be something you hate. You might love minimalist architecture. I might get all excited by Byzantine mosaics. Do you think that's because subconsciously we're each actually looking for something that we need?
Yes, I think that, you know, what we love in art tells us an awful lot about ourselves. But I think particularly it tells us what we're slightly missing. I think the things that we find most beautiful capture in a kind of concentrated dose something which we long for inside but don't have enough of. So just to give you a personal example, what I really find beautiful in art and particularly architecture is emptiness. I love peace, harmony, calm. So I love this kind of minimalist interiors, or I love vistas of the Utah desert. I love the kind of empty canvases of Agnes Martin. You know, that really gets me going. Now, what's going on there? What is it I'm missing? Truth is that day to day I'm assaulted by a million emails, things to do, panic, worries, etc. And what I long for and I find so beautiful is something that is the opposite of that. Similarly, I know people, I've got a good friend of mine who loves Latin American exuberant art. Anything from Brazil gets her going. She wants excitement, etc. And this friend of mine, she's Scottish. She came from a very dour Presbyterian background, very kind of cold family life, etc. And she's trying to warm things up. You know, she's trying to get a sense of drama and collective excitement that she didn't have enough of. So I think all of us are trying to rebalance ourselves. And that explains taste. And I think that's why we should go easy on people who don't share our taste. Before going, that's bad taste, say, what is it you're afraid of? That will tell you an awful lot about why they like that taste.
Well, that also suggests another very interesting thing to do in a museum or gallery exhibition is walk around, watch what you love. Your reaction to art can be a way to explore and discover things about yourself that you didn't know.
Absolutely. And it creates ultimately a portrait of who you are. You know, we say in the book that the most important part of the museum visit at the end of the day is the gift shop, when you can pick up a postcard cheaply. And often one has a relationship with a postcard that you can't have in a museum with lots of people around the picture. But a postcard, you know, you get it, you put it on your pin board, you look at it in idle moments, you can kind of be yourself around it in a way that often you can't be with the work, you know, actually hanging. And all of us, or many of us, could just assemble our own pictures and make our own little museums that are really going to be our autobiographies. We do this naturally with music. We create playlists. I think it's just as possible and just as necessary to create our playlists of pictures, because they are also a guide to what we most need, what we most revere, what most excites us in life.
Well, this is where we should talk about the other project you did in conjunction with the book. You created an app, sort of like a first step toward having a painting playlist you can own.
I've always been thinking about apps and how could we use them sort of in a way that added something to a book rather than just attract it. And so we've come up with this app, which is it's called artisttherapy.com. And you come into it and there's a kind of little diagnostic tool which just gives you various moods. So, you know, if you click on work, click on it and it takes you to an image. Let me give you an example. I've clicked on anxiety and, okay, we're having a bit of fun here because you click on what will happen next week. And we've got a work of art courtesy of NASA. NASA's Hubble telescope has taken probably some of the greatest works of art. They don't hang in museums because of the snobbery, but they should. And it's a picture of a globular cluster, which is a part of the galaxy. And the caption that goes with the work basically says, if you're a little bit worried about what happens next week, sit with a NASA globular cluster taken by the Hubble telescope, and it won't matter so much in a good way. It's really about the way that art can give us perspective on things. There's another picture by the complaint is I find it hard to relax, and I advocate looking at beautiful picture by Sugimoto, the Japanese photographer, of some of the North Atlantic on a misty day, and it's just a huge horizon, and feeling small is a wonderful emotion to go for. Feeling small in a vast universe seriously calms down all the complaints of the ego, the anger, the disappointment that comes from not feeling important enough in the world of men and women. And works of art, again, have this great ability to take us out of ourselves. Very valuable.
So you also created the School of Life in London, which, among other things, offers bibliotherapy, the concept of the novel as cure. Sounds like in the future you could imagine seeing a therapist, and the therapist might prescribe you a book to read and a few paintings to go see.
Absolutely. I mean, we're doing this already. The reason why that sounds strange is that we're used to thinking that culture, you know, the great works, the great pictures, etc., that they don't have any ability to shed light on the great dilemmas and sufferings and pains that all of us go through from the moment of birth to death. I passionately disagree. And my whole professional career has been spent arguing against that. You know, a few years ago, I wrote a book called How Proust Can Change Your Life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Proust scholars came out and said, how do you mean Proust can change your life? And the book was utterly serious. It was an attempt to say, well, of course he can change our lives. If a book matters to us, it's because it can do something for us. And, you know, there's this word self-help, which is in serious trouble. Because when people mention the word self-help, they immediately imagine an idiotic book with a pink cover promising you unrealistic things. It doesn't have to be that way. You know, Plato's Symposium is a self-help book. Emerson's essays are self-help books. Walden's Thoreau is a self-help book. You know, we need to rehabilitate that word. We need to become friends again with the idea that the most serious works of culture can alleviate our day-to-day lives and situations, and that this is not any kind of disparagement or attempt to attack them. It's actually a way of doing them proper justice, because that's what their authors and creators would have wanted.
Alain, now that you've talked about the way you would rearrange a museum, I kind of want to go to that museum. Have any approached you? Are you going to create a museum exhibition?
Three very, very brave institutions have agreed to go along with this suggestion. The nearest one to you is in Toronto, the AGO in Toronto, wonderful museum. They've gone for this. They've said, let's do it. And they are allowing me to transform their museum in early May next year into a giant kind of apothecary, a giant kind of dispensing chemist using the art. So I will be writing 300 labels for works of art and rearranging rooms by theme.
Are you going to rearrange the entire museum?
I will be rearranging the museum. There will be rooms on love. There will be rooms on death. There will be rooms on all sorts of things. And, you know, you'll hear the fireworks from across the Canadian border. I'm doing the same exercise at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam and also a gallery in Australia called the National Gallery of Victoria. And it's an attempt to put this idea into practice and raise some really big questions about how art fits into our lives. And some people won't agree, and that's fine. And, you know, I think people worry that I'll be trying to tell them what to think. It's not at all that. It's an invitation to a more personal relationship with the work of art. That's the idea.
Well, more power to you. Thank you so much. That was terrific.
Thank you. Thanks.